From Social Service.sg, I'm Jing Yao. This month, in the same week that the Department of Statistics revealed that households in the bottom 10% were the group hit hardest by the COVID-19 pandemic, with their monthly total earnings from work falling by 6.1%. Beyond Social Services published its Mind the Chasm report, Beyond documented deep decreases to household incomes from work among low-income families. Among the applicants to Beyond's COVID-19 Family Assistance Fund, they found that as a result of the pandemic, median household income from work dropped by 69%, median per capita income dropped by 74%, and 35% of the applicants had their household incomes dropped to nothing. With the research team, we discuss how the report informs Singapore's discourse on poverty and inequality, the plight of low-income families experiencing insecurities across multiple intersecting dimensions, as well as their three policy recommendations and proposed policy directions. Dr. Stephanie Chalk is lead author and an independent researcher, and community worker Surrender Kumar provided research assistance to the report. Could I first invite the both of you to introduce yourselves? So Stephanie and Kumar, can you introduce yourselves? Tell us a bit more about yourselves.
Okay. So hi, I'm Stephanie. I'm an independent researcher. I got my PhD in the social sciences, and I was previously doing most of my research on migrant workers in Singapore. I joined Beyond in 2019. And then, like, I guess within 6 months, the pandemic hit, and that really shifted the focus of the work. And then we started doing this study on the impact of COVID-19 on low-income families. Currently, I'm no longer a staff member of Beyond, but I'm working with them on a project basis. And we're working on projects related to inequality and food insecurity.
Yeah. Hi. Yeah, I'm Kumar. My pronouns are he, him. And I graduated from political science in NUS not too long ago, like 2019. And Beyond Social Services is my second job. I started, actually, interestingly, smack in the circuit breaker, like on April 1st. Yeah, I came in there and then they said, okay, here's your laptop. I don't want to see you for the next few months. So that's my work. What I was interested in before and what drew me here was my interest in class and inequality. And that's how I knew Steph even before, where I interned at Home, a migrant labor NGO. And my thesis was on low-wage migrant labor and the variations between Tamil and Bangladeshi workers. So naturally, I saw an affinity with Beyond Social Services' mission, which focuses on rental flat households. Yeah.
And at the beginning of this episode, I kind of introduced the main findings from the report. You reported the drop in median household income, the drop in per capita income. But I wanted to start from the very beginning, right? The report itself is titled Mind the Chasm. And I'm interested in why the team and how the team decided on that particular title.
Okay. So I very often hear policymakers and others talk about how you have to mend the cracks or mend the gaps. And I wanted to make it clear how significant and how wide this divide really is, that it's not something accidental or benign or easily fixable. Like, you know, like when people say plug the gap, you kind of imagine you just take something, you plug it, and then it's resolved, right? I think the divide that we have, we need to kind of confront and square up to how large it is, what a huge problem it is, that it's not an incidental thing. It's not something inevitable that we gravitate towards, right? It's something that is a result of intentional policy choices. It's something that is a result of preferred economic models. And we need to kind of admit that it's a really, really large problem. I mean, COVID-19 exacerbated it, but it's been a large problem for a very long time.
And in that sense, because the findings of the drops in median household income and per capita income are not just consistent with the report that was put out by the Department of Statistics about key household trends, but also with a DBS report titled Same Storm, Different Wood, Impact of COVID-19 on Financial Wellness in Singapore, which you quoted heavily and referenced heavily in the report itself. So, you know, being very deliberate in saying chasm and not gap and divide, how do they mirror what Beyond and the team has observed through the research process? Those different reports?
Yeah, so, I mean, the report findings, I felt reinforced what we were finding too, right? Which, I mean, significantly was that the lowest income earners were the hardest hit in terms of percentage income lost, right? So the less they earned, the bigger the income drop was. And I think in the report, if you look at page 10 of the report, you can see visually that red bar, right? It kind of shrinks when it goes, the higher your income is. So basically, I mean, you can see that the gap would be widening in terms of income loss. So the wealthiers in the society, I mean, the impact seems to be, according to the research, also almost negligible in comparison to the impact on low-income earners. I think what was also important was the finding that the low-income earners also had less emergency funds or less savings to tide them over. So they don't have financial buffers as well.
So in saying that as well, because to visualize, in addition to visualizing the drop in incomes and household incomes and per capita income, I think the team, correct me if I'm wrong, was very deliberate in showcasing the 14 kind of case studies to offer kind of additional textures and the main findings also. So, you know, you talked about how the income drops also go beyond just labor insecurity. The report documents food insecurity, housing insecurity, health insecurity, insecurity over legal status, as well as work care gaps and debt. So maybe could you share us, the listeners, one or two case studies reflect kind of this unfortunate intersection across these different forms of insecurities?
Yeah, so there were, As you pointed out, case studies in the report, because even though the key findings really focus on income data, right? I think when we were speaking to families, it became really clear that if we focused only on income and interventions, it's too atomistic, right? You don't kind of consider that families were grappling with multiple forms of insecurity. So for example, one of the case studies, and we talked, we focused on transnational family, and we did see quite a number of transnational families. They think it really bears emphasizing that even among low-income families, there are differential impacts felt. And transnational families really suffered because of policy decisions that impacted on their legal status and their right to work. So for example, there was one family, I think I gave everyone like alphabet pseudonyms in the report, right? So Jay, he's a male Singaporean. He has a polytechnic diploma. He lived in a household of four, well, actually five, because at the time the baby was on the way, so there should be three kids now. So because of COVID-19, he lost his job. And then he found another job delivering parcels. But because his wife and children were on a social visit pass, they had to renew their social visit pass every 3 months. So they have to leave Singapore and then come back again to renew their social visit pass. And during one of these trips, Singapore implemented a short-term ban on short-term pass holders from entering the country. So they got trapped in another country for a while. And because of this, he lost his job that he'd just found. And then when the family finally returned to Singapore, they had to serve the 14-day stay-home notice. And during this time, he was, you know, unable to work, couldn't look for a job, children were not allowed to go to school. And I mean, during this period of time, his income kind of just basically dropped to zero. And then there were a lot of persons who were in transition as well. So there were families where women were going through divorce, so they move out the family home. Well, not just women, but mostly women. There were also persons who just come out from prison, and it was very discombobulating for them to come out into kind of pandemic situation. So we had another lady, we call her S, right? She was 46 years old. She recently filed for divorce. She had no place to stay because her mother lived in a one-room flat and she had her kids with her, so she moved into the sister's house. She had no income, but she couldn't find work because her child was too young and she had to put the child in childcare. But at that point of time, childcare centers were closed. So I think the work care gap is also something that we kind of really need to note, especially for women. And then she was also really worried about, because of the COVID situation, the divorce proceedings would also be delayed. And at each stage, there would be fees that need to be paid. And this delay in confirming her marital status, her new marital status, would also affect her ability to apply for certain subsidies and affect housing options. Yeah, so these are kind of, I guess, two case studies that demonstrate how things were additionally complicated during the COVID-19 situation. I think maybe other case studies would talk a little bit about the relationship between health, which was another issue that came up a lot, this causal relationship between poverty and health, where a lot of families were grappling with either their own health conditions or their family's health conditions. And this really impacted on their employment opportunities. And we also spoke to applicants for whom the loss of income affected their ability to care for their health. So they were skipping medical appointments, or they were not wanting to go for appointments because they couldn't afford, they knew they couldn't afford their medicines. Yeah.
And maybe I should also point to one of the key findings. So like Jay itself, you mentioned in your report that 35% of applicants had their household income dropped to nothing, which is something that Jay experienced. So wondering, Kumar, whether there were case studies that stood out to you or things that a few case studies that you thought were particularly significant when drafting and writing the report.
Yeah, I mean, I think like what Steph was saying kind of echoes the discourse that is a bit lacking in Singapore, I feel. And it's the idea that you know, we tend to see poverty and inequality as things separate from gender inequality of like the carceral system, things related to sexuality, things related to race, things related to citizenship. Like, okay, this is a migrant labor issue. This is a low income issue. But what you really see when Steph uses that analytical framework of these different forms of insecurities, right? It's just how it's all intersected and you're being, if you're living that reality as somebody who's of the lower income, you don't have the privilege of seeing things in these separate lenses. They all just come at you like that. And so I guess, I mean, the case studies that struck me for was I think the ones that felt the most distant for me. So like, especially those who experience incarceration. So a lot of people who experience incarceration, like I think as Steph said, was very discombobulating, and it had a huge impact on the household, right? Because usually, let's assume like the male worker in the household was incarcerated. Then and let's, you know, say that they have a child. I mean, he's married and he has a child. It's the burden really falls on the wife here in the household. And it's also very, very discombobulating for the wife to come back. And then now, instead of having the male come back to the household and you know, provide the income, it's actually additional responsibility during COVID, where you have a lesser supply of jobs, where you have on top of the discrimination you face as somebody who just went through incarceration, and often quick question is, what is your criminal record? Now you even if you didn't have a criminal record, there is a lack of jobs. And I think if you point to some existing research, sociological research, right, as to like what really helps people who have some sort of incarceration history, it's a lot of social capital, right? So it's if you have these links with SME businesses and so on, and a lot of these programs for more jobs and all that, I'm sure they help, but like what really seemed to work was the social capital. And that was also our experience. I felt like when we look at it, it really depended on whether they knew somebody who had a job or who can trust them. Sometimes they feel like they have to hide their criminal record. I know at least one person who did that, and then the company found out later, and then he was retrenched. Like, just, I mean, he was fired right off the bat. It's these protections, right, that I think really struck out to me, the lack of it, so to speak. Recently, I mean, we had a discussion about anti-discrimination laws in the workplace, and we're still not really getting anywhere closer to having that kind of law on anti-discrimination.
Also, there were a lot of small invisible costs that came out when we were doing the calls. I remember there was one man who'd just come up from prison and he'd started his first job. So I think maybe people might think, oh, okay, so now you're working, you don't need to get financial assistance. But then he was sharing that because he'd been in prison for a number of years, when he came out, none of his clothes fit him anymore. He needed to buy new clothes. He didn't have a mobile phone, right? So he had to get a new mobile phone. He'd get new data plan. And then suddenly he had to also get an EZLink card, take care of transport. So if you want to support people to find work, you need to kind of think about all these invisible costs as well in setting up the person for moving into the labor market after a very long period away. Yeah.
And I want to get to the... Oh, sorry, Kumar, go ahead.
Yeah, sorry. I just wanted to also add invisible costs, but also the... especially, I'm already going back to people who are incarcerated, right? What a lot of times, okay, let's say they have to fulfill parole. What happens is that they need to go and consult their prison officer every week, once a week. And that's very disruptive, right, to a job. And especially with the way that the report talks about this, right, non-standard forms of employment. And we talk about gig work, for example, where, you know, they call you and you need to be there and you're not there. That it's really hard. So that I think was a big factor. Like they are trying to rehabilitate, but the means of rehabilitation is is itself the stumbling block for them to actually rehabilitate. It's kind of like when I heard them speak, I could really hear the frustration. It was just like, I'm trying, I want to fulfill this, but it's so hard. And it pushes them out of the system, doesn't it? It pushes them to think like, you know, what, maybe I should just try something else, or I should just go back to what I was doing. So it's really hard. I think like, while we've made strides, it's we still have a long way to go. There's a huge chasm. You see, the chasm just gets bigger and bigger with the more intersections you see. When you talk about incarceration, when you talk about race, when you talk about gender, you talk about citizenship, it just gets bigger and bigger and bigger. Yeah.
Yeah, and with what Stephanie started with transnational families as well, that's another intersection that complicates situations as well. And this is something that I want to touch on in the next question on policy directions. But before that, the team kind of collected data from the 1,231 families between April and September. I guess before we touch upon the policy suggestions and directions, I was wondering whether through your interactions or traditional data collection, if we understand if any of these families have been able to recover some of their lost incomes, or if a lot of these challenges have persisted even after circuit breaker and after phase two and in three right now.
Well, I think I can't speak for how the 1,231 families are now, but out of some of the families that I'm still in touch with, because Koma and I are both part of the FAF team as well, I mean, they're still struggling. And for some, maybe earnings are marginally better, but there are also deterioration in other aspects, for example, mental health, right? Because of the prolonged impact on income. There are also a few that I knew who were pregnant during that time, and now they've just given birth. So I'm also kind of wondering how they're dealing with the additional costs of milk and diapers and caring for a young infant. If you look at the sectors and occupations that most of them were in, right? Retail, security, I mean, you can just kind of guess that the situation may have improved slightly, but not enough. So those that were like working in entertainment industry, like in nightclubs, for example, or in the pasar malams, those are still shut, right? So unless they've managed to find work, and then again, if you look at the educational qualifications, what then is available for them in the labor market, I would guess that the situation would still be, many of them would still be struggling. Yeah. Kumar?
Yeah. I think that's right. I can't speak for the team that does the Family Assistance Fund, but you know, having conversations with them and having conversations with some of the members that we did calls with, they're still struggling. They're still struggling. It's probably going to get worse, I find, with some things that have recently happened with, for example, the petrol hike that was announced. That will probably affect a lot of the gig workers who rely on motorcycles and even PSC drivers. There are some PSC drivers, and there's private hire car drivers. And we also have, you know, people who do their own delivery, they're independently contracted. I think in MOM, they would call them own account drivers or own account workers. These people get affected because the company doesn't pay for their fuel. There is some subsidy. I think Grab does some subsidy, but it's still not enough to offset the cost. Petrol is one. The other thing is the GST hike. I mean, if you think about it, right? One thing that's always puzzled me is that, yes, you know, GST and petrol, I mean, low-income people are not, low-income workers aren't the only ones who take petrol and you know, consume goods, right? Rich people do too. But the thing is, what proportion of their income is actually affected? It's adversely affecting those who are lower income. And it's just a bit of a puzzling statistic for me. I mean, not statistic, but puzzling move for me to see, because it almost seems as if like the lower income are disproportionately paying refinancing COVID. And it just doesn't make sense to me when you look at the wider stat of like how people were affected during COVID and what exactly the recovery entails, right? The recovery entails what? Let me just quote from the report, actually. It says here, the DBS report, right? It showed that lower income earners experienced the sharpest income losses, more than 50% due to the pandemic. But meanwhile, in August 2020, it was reported that Singapore's 50 richest saw their collective wealth rise by 28% to 220 billion. And in October, Singapore gained 3 more billionaires and total billionaire wealth grew by 30% between April to July to 135 billion. So where is the cost for this class, right? It just seems very uneven and it doesn't seem to correlate with the experience, right? If we were talking about recovery, we're talking about building back better, then how are we building back better for the lower income, and what is the efficacy of the current, you know, proposals that went out? I'm sure like temporary relief fund was was very helpful. COVID support grant was also very helpful, but they need to be expanded. These efforts need to be rolled out more than a one-off kind of basis. And like the COVID-19, there's a relief fund for drivers. I think that's also a good move, but it's still not enough. And when you have that and you have the GST and the petrol hike, it's just like we made two steps ahead and then we made one step back. So it's just that issue, that puzzle.
A few primers. First, you'll hear the team refer to FAF, or the COVID-19 Financial Assistance Fund. Beyond launched the FAF in 2020 to support low-income families adversely affected by the pandemic. Second, Kumar refers to a recent hike in petrol duties announced with immediate effect during the 2021 budget speech. The duty for premium-grade petrol has gone up by 15 cents per litre and 10 cents a litre for intermediate-grade petrol. Third, Kumar cites from a DBS report titled "Same Storm, Different Boat: Impact of COVID-19 on Financial Wellness in Singapore." The DBS report is also referenced in the Mind the Chasm report and is linked in the show notes. Yeah, and that's a really good point, because that you're pointing to how there was the availability of short-term relief, but the report, the Mind the Chasm report, also points to longer-term proposed solutions. The three solutions that the team proposes are a lot more long-term. One of it is quite immediate. A few of them are quite immediate, but it's pointing to more long-term changes. And if I made the report right, and I quote, "Essential work, however, is not just underappreciated. It is often poorly paid and now much more perilous as the privilege, as Kumar, you mentioned, retreat into safety when infections peak. Essential workers occupy the front lines, commute by public transport and contend with hostility and harassment from customers when trying to enforce social distancing measures, all this without adequate social and labor protection." So I thought this was a great kind of like next segue to talk about the three policy recommendations or three policy directions that the team proposes. The first one, the team says, motivating key structural changes through strengthened employment rights and social protection. So tell us more about what you mean by that direction.
It was clear that the majority of the FAF applicants and their family members were in what the ILO calls non-standard forms of employment. So it'd be like casual, part-time, contracted workers, or workers in the gig economy. And workers in the gig economy, the ILO terms, disguise self-employment, right? So the precariousness that they experienced was due to income and job insecurity and to a lack of substantive social protection. So, for example, lack of paid sick leave or childcare leave, which during the pandemic, you know, became really clear how important those were. So I think if we are in a position now to kind of so-called build back better or stronger, and we are creating so many thousands of jobs, right? I mean, we really need to consider job quality, right? What sort of wages are being paid? What sort of working conditions are being provided? What sort of employment relationships are we enabling? So the labor market conditions pre-COVID were not kind to low-paid workers in these sectors. And we need to kind of really confront the exploitative conditions that exist for them and not kind of allow them to continue, because that's part of what enabled or created that vulnerability in the first place, right? And if you're going to kind of create new jobs, you don't want to recreate those same conditions. And can we at least admit that conditions were exploitative, that the wages were inadequate, and change those conditions going forward? Yeah.
So there was employment and social protection. I guess second one, moving to the second one on housing, right? The team proposes that we should provide short to midterm relief to substantial extended debt rent relief for public rental flat occupants. So speak to that policy direction recommendation.
So if you look at the figures in our report, right? I mean, people were paying rent as high as $800, although that was just one person, but there were quite a number of paying like $200-$300 a month in rent. And, you know, if you consider the steep income drops, then, you know, the rebates we feel should be extended. So HDB gave a 50% rebate for 3 months. But if you look at income drops, if you look at the situation, I mean, the economic situation for persons in these sectors, then clearly they're going to be struggling financially for an extended period of time. So to alleviate the financial burden, right, you know, we hope that they would consider extending the rebate, so more than 3 months, and hopefully more than 50% to reflect the income drop, because rent as a percentage of their income also doubled, right, during this period. So this is really just to kind of ensure that there's kind of a financial relief for a significant portion of their budget.
And I think in the longer term, which is the third recommendation, which is dealing with longer term problem through debt relief. So tell us about what is meant by debt relief and how important that is for these households and families with whom Beyond works and with whom, you know, with low income families in Singapore.
Yeah, so with the issue of debt, right, I think it was really a red flag kind of recommendation. I think we need a lot more people to come forward with ideas and recommendations on how to deal with debt, because there aren't very clear programs except for the Methodist Welfare Center kind of debt matching program. But it was really a situation where I felt it was important to red flag this. Debt is a huge problem. And if I didn't make this clearer in the report, then I apologize. But it's also really about asking policymakers to and others to think about the problem of debt, and not just debt relief, which is just patching up the problem, but why do people go into debt in the first place, right? And that would be related to the issue of adequacy, right? Is it that people are not earning enough so they can't pay for their basic needs of themselves and their families? Is it crisis situations that tip them into debt? And then the lack of emergency funds or savings then is a problem, right? So what is it that keeps them in this kind of precarious financial situation? Then we need to examine the processes of financial exclusion, right? So many people, including those with more money, rely on credit, right? So relying on credit is commonplace, right? But what are the sources of credit that are available to middle and higher income persons versus the low income, who then are caught up in predatory schemes like higher purchase schemes, like, for example, by retailers who charge exorbitant interest rates and then they get caught. So what is it that enables and creates debt spirals? You know, so debt relief is the patching up, right? That's a recommended solution. But if you want to deal with debt, but if you don't deal with debt, why people get into debt in the first place? And then we just give financial assistance. It's almost like pouring water through a sieve, right? So for example, when we were giving financial assistance, it was a real problem because I was speaking to applicants and they'd be telling me that they haven't had incomes for 2 to 3 months. And then like they admit that they've been borrowing money from friends or family. And then I'll do the mental calculations in my head and I'm thinking, okay, I can only give you a couple of $100 for another 3 months. That amount actually is the amount that you borrowed to tide yourself through for the last 3 months. So the money is going to go to pay your debts, and then you still have to figure out how you're going to feed your family, pay your debts, and then you probably have to borrow again, right? So I strongly feel that if we don't confront the issue of debt, right, then a lot of the other measures that we're thinking of are not really going to help people get out of poverty or debt cycles.
Yeah, if I might add, right, so like the debt issue, I think one that really struck out to me was the, and I think Steph also would agree, was the higher purchase loans that a lot of families take from a certain company. I wouldn't say which one it is, but this company charges really exorbitant interest rates. And it's because these a lot of these low-income families don't have that kind of enough capital or income to buy from somewhere else that doesn't allow for such installment plans. Things, very essential things, right? Like microwave ovens, fridges and all that. It's not like they're buying a boombox speaker or something like that, but it's really essential things to really keep the household going. And so they get sucked into these higher purchase loans, and they end up paying exorbitant interest rates. Like I remember, Steph, you were talking about the according to our law, for licensed money lenders, the maximum interest rates you can charge is 4.8 or 4.7%. But for this particular higher purchase loans from these companies, it's way higher than that. And we're just wondering what explains the variance in the law. And it seems like there is this loophole for private contracts, commercial contracts. And that is something that is not helping the chasm, right? And the other thing is, I mean, I totally agree with Steph about debts being, like, not accounting for debts, actually, in the way we consider how to address low income, what issues go through, people with low income go through. For example, I mean, I used to live in a rental flat, right? So, like, what I remember going to SSOs, this was, you know, like 10, 15 years ago, right? SSOs and you're trying to get assistance, they never asked me about my debt, actually. They never did. They never asked me how much debts I had. I had to put that, I had to think of that in another section. I had to say, oh, you know, but I've got this housing stuff, you know, these rents that we have not paid yet. Where do I put that? So then I include that. I'm not fully sure if that has changed now with the social work, with the way social work agencies do their job. But it was a huge crack, you know, and it's important that we intervene in debt as soon as possible, because debts are a very real part of poverty. But the problem is that they're invisible. right? You can't really see it. You can go to some. I mean, one thing that we did in the report was that we actually engaged with a lot of people who purchased flats, right? So I mean, we always think that rental flats equals poverty, and that's it, right? People who don't live in rental flats are not poor. That's not true, actually, because a lot of, and the reason why we fall into that trap is because we don't have a poverty line. So we look at proxies and we look at rental flats as a proxy, which is helpful, but it doesn't tell the whole picture. What we saw with a lot of people living in purchased flats is that a lot of them, more of them are actually under, like going through, they have a lot of arrears, they have a lot of debts. Housing, when you buy a house, you get a mortgage, right? And that itself is a stressor. And if you can't pay that mortgage, you don't get evicted, but you get many red letters, and the kind of relief you get for that is not as sympathetic as for rent, because they see it as, oh, you want to own a property, right? So we can't just give you relief like that. So it's not so easy. I know someone, right, who she was widowed not too long ago. Probably, I think, like just at the cusp of COVID, she was widowed and she had 4 kids, and she's a single parent, right? Doing her job, and she was paid really ridiculously low wages, like 700 a month, 750 a month, doing administrative work just for like a small sort of like startup-ish kind of company. And she was laid off via email for that. And she was getting, she was getting letters from HDB saying that you owed this much money, and it was a lot. The interest really, there was no forgiveness in terms of the interest rate during COVID. So big part, actually, when we talk about housing, that we didn't really get a chance to get into was, what about people who are living in HDB who are poor? And who, I mean, you can't tell them to just downgrade right now, right, during COVID. So it's just like, what is being done there? Debts are just accumulating. Yeah, so she is, you know, trying to make ends meet through home-based businesses and so on. But it's not easy. It's really a chasm. And the thing is, you can mine a gap, but you can't mine the chasm, right? You can't just mine the chasm. Chasm is there. It's a structural issue that needs fixing. It needs collective fixing. And just one last point, right? Just to latch on to the employment question. I've been talking about boosting employment rights, right? One thing is that there was one statistic that came out a lot in GE 2020, actually. It was the labor share of income. And that statistic is very important. We don't talk about it enough. But in one statistic that was cited, right, was that Singapore's labor share of income was 42%. So meaning that you know, 58% is capital. Capital shares the income. 42%, that was actually 2014. If you look at 2019, the labor share of income has just gone down. It's 40.5%. If you compare it to, so one level, temporarily, there was a time we've gotten lower, workers share less of the pie than before. And the second thing is that if you compare it to other developed countries, our share of the pie is, workers' shares of the pie is also even lower. So the question is, what this means is that collective bargaining power of workers has deteriorated and has been deteriorating. And, you know, leading up to the COVID, it's just like, you know, there were all these warning signs that workers are losing strength, that they're losing bargaining power when you know, for anything, right? For leave, for wages, for all these things. And then COVID hit, of course, you know, they're gonna be affected. Those even more precarious workers are gonna be even more affected. So I think what employment rights, we also need to talk about how to boost the collective bargaining power of workers, right? You know, this entails things like, we need to talk about collective bargaining and unions, for example, right? Recently, 12 Cupcakes unionized after that incident of a lot of foreign workers being underpaid. This move sounds good, but it also, the point which I think Steph highlighted to me, correct me if I'm wrong, is that yes, foreigners can. So I mean, the issue is foreigners being underpaid. Foreign workers can join unions, correct? But they cannot. I don't know whether it's fully cannot or it's only in certain situations. They cannot necessarily participate in collective bargaining. So the question is, then what's the point of the union? You know, what's the point of joining the union here? And how did this actually help the people who are underpaid?
That point, Kumar, was about the agreement that the union then forges with the company. So there have been situations where the union forges an agreement with the company where they exclude foreigners from collective bargaining. So it's not, to my understanding, it's not regulation. It's about the kinds of agreement and terms that the union then crafts with the company itself. Yeah.
Right. So it's not a right, right? I mean, still not a right that foreign workers have that they will be a part of the collective bargaining. It's really... Yeah. I mean, I don't use the word arbitrary, but it really depends on the contract.
On the agreement that's carved between the union and the company. Yeah.
Singapore's labor share of income was referenced during the general election last year. Some academics have also argued that the country's labor share of gross domestic product or GDP is very low, whereas the share of profits or returns to capital is very high. Towards the end of the previous segment, Dr. Chok and Kumar discussed the successful unionization of 12 Cupcakes. Pastry company has been in the spotlight for its owners' underpayment of foreign staff. And in that sense, we kind of, we're landing up where we started, which is because Kumar, you mentioned before you talked about the 12 Cupcakes example was that it's not a gap, it's not a divide, but it's a chasm, right? So I imagine that both of you, you have a lot of experience researching, working with agencies like Beyond and interacting with many of these low-income families. And what you're seeing through the report or what the reader sees through the report or what you've seen through the COVID-19 kind of circuit breaker experience, it's not new, as in you've seen a lot of these experiences even before the pandemic itself. So I guess in a way, it's a two question and we'll probably end with this for each of you. What, even though with this knowledge, what surprised you most in this research process? And what was kind of like a learning point that you had from doing this project, this Mind and Chasm project or report?
Okay, so I think one thing that I could never get used to was the levels of and the numbers of food insecure households and persons that we encountered. Yes, you know that there are families that are struggling, but it's kind of really difficult to accept that in a country that's so wealthy and when we have such high levels of food wastage, there's still so many people who are struggling to find enough to eat, right? I kind of remember quite clearly that there was one applicant whom I reached out to because he seemed quite distressed. And I explained to him where I worked and everything. And the first thing he said to me via text message was, "Hi, Stephanie, can I have food?" Right? This is a grown adult, you know, and it kind of really stumped and shocked me. And I really don't think people would just come out and ask a stranger for food if they really didn't need it, right? So it I think made us think about, so this is also the reason why we started on another project. So we have another research project ongoing now about food insecurity because, yeah, so it really shocked me at the levels of food insecurity among the households that we were speaking to. The other thing that kind of caused a lot of reflection was this kind of the outpouring of gratitude that a lot of applicants had. And what I felt was very discomforting because as a gatekeeper to financial assistance, I had this kind of unearned power over persons, right? Suddenly I was part of a team that could give money. And I think the more discretionary power you have, the more you should really examine that, you know? And I think we really need to think a lot more generally about the politics of giving, especially since number one, more charities are being set up all the time. I mean, who's quality controlling the gatekeepers, you know, and there's so many philanthropists and foundations. And the state is also kind of encouraging charities to plug the gaps, right? But first of all, what are the state's responsibilities versus what charities should do? And even as charities, what are our responsibilities, right? So I strongly believe that we should not have people depend on the benevolence of others just to meet their basic needs, right? When people say to me, "Oh, you know, without the money from Beyond, I wouldn't have been able to survive." It's very troubling to me. I don't feel like, oh, I deserve that gratitude. I feel like screaming, but you shouldn't have to depend on this kind of temporary assistance to survive, right? It's wrong. And I think we need to kind of not just absorb that gratitude without thinking about our roles as gatekeepers. And then the final point is more about research and social service agencies, right? I think this was really an opportunity at that point where we were already going to collect large amounts of data, administrative data on financial assistance applicants. And fortunately, we were positioned in Beyond as researchers, even as we were on the FAF team. So we played a dual role, right? We were administering FAF as part of FAF team, but we were also putting on the research hat to think about strategically, how can we systematically collect this data in a way and make it useful? And I think that there's an opportunity there for other agencies to also think about if you're already collecting data. But of course, always keeping in mind that you need to observe research ethics. You need to ensure there's informed consent. And you cannot make assistance dependent on whether or not they want to share information with you, right? So we were quite clear about giving people the choice to opt out. But I do think that a lot of persons doing work on the ground have a lot of encounters and collect a lot of data already that can be used for research and advocacy. And maybe some thought could be given to that.
On food insecurity, the Lian Center for Social Innovation just published the country's first nationally representative study on food insecurity. Its researchers estimate that 10.4% of Singaporeans experienced food insecurity at least once in the last 12 months. On homelessness, which will be referenced later, a 2019 nationwide street count concluded that there were between 921 and 1,050 street homeless people in Singapore. Both reports are linked in the show notes.
Yeah, for me, what is surprising, I guess actually it was just seeing everything come out at the end, because it was like, I used to live in a rental flat, right? And these, a lot of these experiences, even when I'm reading Toh Yuen's book, it's like, wow, somebody's telling this story that you know, a lot of us were feeling, and that I experienced it too. But there's a special feeling when you read it out loud and other people are reading it with you and realize that this is information that is officialized to some extent. And it's a kind of validation that is really, really so important. I think poverty and inequality are traumatic processes. And that, I think in this country, we don't validate enough. We have people who said before that poverty doesn't exist in Singapore, that homelessness, there's no such thing as homeless people in Singapore. It's not a nice thing for somebody who is poor, who feels poverty, who feels homelessness to hear. And what happens is that you tend to blame yourself for a lot of choices, right? You think that, oh, you know, if I just didn't buy that TV, or if I just didn't buy that chicken from NTUC, right? If maybe I went to Sheng Siong instead and bought it like 50 cents cheaper, you know, then maybe like my son wouldn't have, you know, issues with his school fees. Just listen to that. Like, what kind of discourse is that, right? What kind of choices does this kind of experience entail? Like, these shouldn't be choices, right? I really echo what Steph said about like how shocking these things can be for people who don't experience it. But for me, it's like, yeah, this was it. And I thought, you know, it was embarrassing to talk about it, because you're just like, are you talking about your own individual failure? You're talking about, you know, your family's individual failure. But when you realize how pervasive it is, it becomes like the median household income drop was 69%. And this is out of 1,000 over families. And you're like, okay, so I'm not alone in this, right? So there must be something structural about it. There is something, there's something to be said about this. And when that happens, I think there's a lot of validation that happens. And it gives you some sort of confidence. It gives you some sort of energy to go like, okay, this is something that we can actually address, right? That there's something structural here going on, that it's a chasm. It's not just a gap I can just mind, right? I can just curb. So I think that was really what struck me. And the other thing, I'm just going to end my point on this, which is that I think like this research has value for sure. Like, most research reports have a lot of value, but the value really isn't going to be realized unless social workers talk about it, right? Unless social workers use this kind of data to talk to their members, to talk to to people in the community, to say, what do you think about this statistic? 69%, the median income, the household drop was 69%. 30+% people were, their incomes dropped to zero. Do you think this is fair, right? And when you ask the question, then it's like, okay, why do you think this is happening, right? What do you think can be done? These are important conversations to have on top of putting out daily fires like that people are going through, right? If your house is on fire, you go and give them aid, you go try to put out the fire. But you need to go find out what is the source of the fire, right? What is festering these fires and all that. So the research itself is not going to have that much value unless people talk about it, unless people use it for action, right? For further action. So yeah, that's all.
Thank you. Thank you both for the work that you, thank you for producing the report. And hopefully, and I think it will spark, as Kumar, you mentioned, conversations and using the report and subsequent conversations and with policymakers, with families with whom they work, committees with whom they work, and with different agencies as well. So thank you very much, both.
Thanks for having us.
You're welcome. Yeah, thanks for having us.